8-6. The White Sox beat Minnesota 4-3. The schedule tonight, the Brewers play in Cincinnati, Cubs play in Pittsburgh, and the White Sox are off. Northwoods League Baseball, the Kenosha Kingfish lost to the Traverse City Pittsbitters 2-1. The team stays in Michigan to play the Kalamazoo Growlers tonight. Now the WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service for this Monday, 1st of July. Should be partly sunny, hot, and humid. Today's high heading 487. New numbers are in, now 74 degrees in both Racine and Kenosha. Humidity at 94%. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, welcoming approximately 150 full-time transfer students each year. Eligible Gateway graduates can receive guaranteed admission to Carthage to complete their bachelor's degrees. Transfer to a more personalized education in 4 easy steps. More information about admissions and competitive scholarships for transfers now available at carthage.edu/admissions/transfer. Support for the morning show also comes from Jack Andrea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911 and newly reimagined for 2019. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. JackAndrea.com. The morning show starts shortly.
We are talking on today's morning show about a very important issue and a concern which is of mounting urgency here in the United States. The very real possibility, in fact, more than a possibility, I think it's fair to call it a certain reality that American students are falling behind their international counterparts when it comes to the so-called STEM fields, science, technology, engineering, and math. And there are a lot of people in the know who are greatly alarmed about this, wondering about the possible consequences of this, and probably consequences with which the United States is already living in terms of falling behind other nations and seeing maybe a deterioration in our stature in the world economically and in terms of other kinds of influence. And if this situation is not turned around and adequately addressed, some people are really predicting rather dire consequences for the United States and its place in the world. At hand is a book called STEM the Tide, Reforming Science, Technology, Engineering, and Math Education in America. Its author is David E. Drew, the Platt Professor of Education, Management, and Mathematics at the Claremont Graduate University, and author of a previous book, also published by Johns Hopkins University Press, called Aptitude Revisited, Rethinking Math and Science Education for America's Next Century. Professor Drew, in this book, examines some of the misassumptions that we make about who is able to succeed in studies of science and math, for instance, and beyond, of course, some of those misassumptions we make, plots out some strategies by which we can do a much better job of educating a wider swath of Americans in these really crucial academic arenas. Again, this book is called STEM the Tide. And Professor David E. Drew, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, as you outline the issue of this phenomenon of us falling behind comparable students, counterparts in other places, when it comes to these subject matters, it sounds like there are a couple of things going on that are contributing to the problem. One of them being those that study these areas are maybe not succeeding as well as we might want them to, but also that many people find themselves not drawn to these areas in the first place, or lose interest in them quickly. And so we're talking about a couple of different things here: untapped potential, and we're also talking about failing to teach these kinds of subject matters as effectively as we can. Let's begin with the first matter about all those who fail to really explore these STEM areas for one reason or another. Just how serious a problem is this?
I think it's a critical problem in all of these discussions of STEM education, and arguably the most critical problem. There are many students who easily could master STEM, could master math and science education, who, for one reason or another, never try it. And let me make a couple of distinctions. I'm talking here mainly about middle school and high school. And the choices students make really when they're in seventh, eighth, ninth grade as to what courses they'll be taking then and in high school. I'm not talking about, for this part of the discussion, I'm not talking about the choices students make in college, and we can get to that later. I believe that students should choose the career that interests them, regardless of whether or not the United States needs more people in STEM careers. But even students who are not going to go into what are traditionally thought of as STEM careers, even students who don't plan to become scientists, mathematicians, engineers, will need and will benefit from study of math and science in high school. And perhaps the key problem is that many students are discouraged and have traditionally been discouraged from studying these subjects because somebody, a teacher or a counselor, basically thinks they're not smart enough. And that assumption, that communication to the student, almost always is wrong. That is, most students, almost every student, has the capacity to master math and science at the high school level. And we should encourage students to study those subjects. And underlying all of this, and underlying that excellent introduction you just gave to the issue, is the fact that our economy has changed. First, many years ago, from fundamentally a farming economy to an industrial economy, and then more recently, from an industrial economy to a high-tech information economy. And in this new economy, which also is a global economy, math and science education in K through 12 is increasingly important. All too frequently in the past, and still to this day, students are advised, well, you know, sometimes they'll still be advised, girls aren't that good at mathematics. That's been changing, and that whole situation has been changing and changing for the better. Or people make other assumptions about who has the aptitude to master the subject. And I argue very strongly that it's not about aptitude, and that most students can master the subject. And in this book, I spend a considerable amount of time talking about why it's not about aptitude.
I found this to be a really intriguing part of the book, and you quote a number of different experts and authors, including someone named Sheila Tobias, who has written a book I'm sure a lot of people have heard about called Overcoming Math Anxiety, when she talks about math anxiety and math avoidance, and the fact that there may be interesting reasons why certain people find themselves fearful of exploring some of these areas. And I wonder if you could put your finger on what you think are the most important factors, aside from what you've already mentioned, which is that sometimes in both overt ways and maybe in inadvertent ways, we tend to steer a lot of students away from these areas. But are there also things about this subject matter that a lot of students find intimidating? And what are those significant factors?
Yes, let me begin by restating the question in a sense, and then I'd like to answer it. Over and over again, I run into people who say, you know, when I was a child, I had an interest in science, and I really wanted to explore it, and then I took algebra, then I took calculus, and I had a terrible experience, and for the first time in my life, I got a bad grade, and I decided, you know, that field wasn't for me. I think there are several things happening here that contribute to that, and one is that many people who teach math or different parts of mathematics, different levels of mathematics, in junior high school and high school and in college, are very good at mathematics, but not that skilled at communicating mathematics to students who have trouble getting it initially, which is most students. Many teachers take the approach, you know, this material is really difficult. I can master it. If a student's very bright, they can master it. I'm not going to worry about the others. I shouldn't say many teachers do that, but some teachers do that. And to me, that's the opposite of the approach of an effective educator. An effective educator wants to bring every student he or she faces to the point of mastery. I think also students need to be shown, and it's not difficult to do, that math can be relevant to their world, relevant to their work world, relevant to their daily lives. Often, some of us find mathematics a beautiful abstraction, but we need to show how that abstraction translates into real-life problems, real-life solutions. Mm. And, you know, there's a metaphor that I use about this issue, about the questions of do students have the aptitude to master the subject and how should we approach it. And that has to do with learning to drive. It's only a metaphor, but I think it helps to frame the question. When my daughters approached the age of 16, each one wanted to get a learner's permit and then a driver's license. And they knew that they might fail the driving test once or twice, but that they'd eventually pass it. They knew they might fail the written test once or twice, but that they'd eventually pass it. That's really how I think we should look at education, at STEM education. Eventually, every young person masters the skills and learns to drive. And we don't really ask questions about, I wonder if they have the aptitude to drive. And if someone says, well, driving isn't the same as a challenging cognitive problem, challenging a subject that really challenges you cognitively, another example would be learning your first language, learning to speak English. That's an immensely complicated cognitive task. Everybody masters it, and we assume that everybody will master it.
I am reminded of something a former girlfriend of mine said, who was a high school math and science teacher, as a matter of fact, and coming to the point of relevance of what was being studied. And, of course, in many cases, students are studying something that happens to be relevant, but maybe in not the most obvious sorts of ways. But I remember Chris time and time again would tell her students when they felt like what they were learning to do didn't matter. One of the things she would say, particularly if a student was perhaps not destined or didn't see themselves as destined for great achievement in academia down the road, she would always say, you know, if you get a job at the Earl May Garden Center downtown and the owner teaches you the cash register, how many times do you think he's going to want to show that to you before you finally get it? I mean, it is important for you to learn how to learn things, that just the exercise of learning, particularly mathematics and some of these STEM areas, in fact, help a student sharpen their skills for learning anything, even if there is no more math or science in their future. Just the fact that they have learned how to learn is incredibly valuable. But of course, beyond that, if they're encouraged then to persist and do as well as they can, that might in fact lead to more math and more science and all kinds of possibilities in their future. But I thought that was an interesting point she was making, and I wonder if you would agree that these STEM areas, even beyond what they lead to potentially, are also intrinsically valuable in how they teach a student about learning itself.
Yes. In fact, there's an increasing research now on neuroscience because we have devices that allow us to scan the brain and a variety of reasons that we're learning more about how the brain functions. And there's neuroscience evidence that there are neural pathways that are connected when you're studying a demanding subject that involves logical thinking. And those pathways come in useful for in other situations that are not inherently mathematical. And I really like that example from your friend's teaching. I have a colleague who is now a principal but has been a teacher, and a school principal and has been a teacher. And sometimes when he teaches a math class, let's say if he's substituting for an absent teacher, the students will say, I hate math. And his reply to them will be, do you like money? And they'll say, yeah, we like money. And he'll say, making money, increasing the amount of money, it's all about mathematics. And that gets their attention, and he shows the relevance immediately. Something that that I do, and these are just a couple of examples, not the only examples, but something I do in my teaching, I teach statistical analysis. I work with graduate students, and even PhD students will arrive at their graduate studies not looking forward to studying statistics. And I talk a little bit about the history of statistics, which may seem like an arcane, esoteric subject, but it's one I find fascinating. And many of the statistical techniques were developed by mathematicians in the Middle Ages who worked with aristocrats who were gamblers. It emerged out of, the techniques emerged out of gambling situations. So there are ways to not only to show the relevance, but to do it in fun and interesting ways.
Your book touches on the fact that when it comes to untapped potential, students failing to enter some of these fields or to study some of these subject matters, that we're talking about alarming statistics among women and also among certain minorities and particularly disadvantaged youth. First of all, would you say one or the other of these areas is a problem that is especially acute?
Yes. The area that's more acute is the achievement gap between majority students, between, on the one hand, white and Asian students, and on the other hand, underrepresented minority students, African American and Latino students, there's also still an achievement gap between boys and girls, men and women. But I also want to communicate, or want to begin this part of the discussion by communicating, what you will have read in the book, which is that I'm fundamentally optimistic. I think this achievement gap easily can be closed. I give numerous examples of how that has happened in a variety of contexts, both projects with that I've been directly involved with and other projects. I try to draw together the best examples from across the country. So I think it's a serious problem. I think it's a problem both for the nation and for those individuals, individuals who live in poverty, and young people who don't realize that they could attend college, that they could have a career in STEM. And I give a number of examples and systematic data of how that achievement gap can be closed.
Are we talking about achievement gaps that are especially serious when it comes to the area of STEM subjects, or is that just among a number of academic areas in which this achievement gap is present? In other words, are we talking about an especially serious achievement gap when it comes to STEM subject matter, or is it just that STEM subject matter is the primary focus of your book?
At the risk of sounding like a professor, which I am, it's really both, and this is what I mean. There is an achievement gap that needs to be erased in most subjects, but it's more acute in the STEM fields. And as I say, I talk in the book about a number of projects, schools, universities, where this problem has been dealt with, and where students are succeeding in STEM, students who might not have thought they could. Mm. And if I could take a minute, I'll give one dramatic example of that. But I want to underscore that my book is based on systematic statistics and data. One example doesn't prove anything, but one example does illustrate the strategies and techniques that I talk about in the book. I've worked for a number of years with colleges and universities in Houston who received a federal grant to try to increase and broaden the participation in STEM fields in college, to increase the number of women, the number of minority students who got bachelor's degrees in STEM subjects. This consortium of schools in Houston was dramatically successful. They came just shy of doubling the number of graduates in 5 years, and I present those statistics and talk about them. Here's the story of one student. I interviewed him when he was a college senior. He was an African American. He is an African American young man. He grew up in an impoverished neighborhood, went to a mediocre high school. He doubted that he was college material, although he did apply to two colleges. The first one he heard from turned him down. At that point, he concluded he wasn't college material, and he moved from Houston to Albany, New York, where his parents were divorced, where his father lived, and he took a job. Then he heard from the University of Houston downtown that he had been accepted in the STEM program to which he'd applied, which was in computer science. He returned to Houston, started that program, had to take some math courses. It turned out he took to math like a fish to water. He loved math. He changed from computer science to mathematics. It turned out he excelled in mathematics. When I interviewed him, he had won a multi-state competition among undergraduate math majors. He had been offered and he turned down a job with the National Security Agency in Washington because he was particularly interested in the mathematics of encryption. And he turned it down because, quotes, "I don't believe in spies." And he's now doing graduate work in mathematics. This is a young man who hadn't thought college was in his future, who hadn't thought STEM was in his future, who's a graduate student in mathematics.
Hmm. That's quite a story. And, of course, if we could multiply that story many times over, a lot of this grim situation would change dramatically, wouldn't it?
Yes, it would, and I think we can. And again, the story is meant to illustrate what I have seen many times over.
Hmm.
I work with a number of colleges and universities, also with secondary schools. I work with a number of colleges and universities, including many of what are called the historically black colleges and universities, and I see it again and again. In the book, I outline the factors that that create success and close the achievement gap. One of the most critical factors is mentoring. I discuss in this book some world-class mentors, also, again, systematic statistics from across the nation. But here's an example of a world-class mentor. I've also worked with a consortium of universities in Louisiana for a number of years. I work with a physicist, among others. I work with a physicist at Southern University, a historically black university, whose name is Diola Bagayoko. Diola is originally from Mali. In the 12th century, there was a world-respected institution of higher education in Mali called the Timbuktu Academy. Diola, teaching students in the physics department at Southern University, created a mentoring academy, which he called the Timbuktu Academy. His model was enormously successful. It has now spread to other departments at Southern, B, to other universities in Louisiana, and C, across the country. 3 years ago, the American Association for the Advancement of Science named Diola Bagayoko the outstanding mentor in the United States. In the book, I interview several of his students. One person I interviewed, and these are students, his students tend to be they're African-American students, almost all of them. They, most of them are from impoverished neighborhoods in New Orleans and Baton Rouge. I interviewed one student who was just completing his PhD in physics at Caltech, another who was on the faculty at Yale, and he had many, many other success stories. So mentoring is critical.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Professor David E. Drew. We're talking about his book, STEM the Tide, Reforming Science, Technology, Engineering, and Math Education in America. He's well known for a previous book called Aptitude Revisited, Rethinking Math and Science Education for America's Next Century. One of the things you mention about the sciences, and I suspect that to some extent mathematics is also a relevant example of this, is that maybe one thing that is, let's call it kind of a turnoff or a source of intimidation for many students, and maybe for minority students in particular, as you mention in the book, is this thing about language. And of course, we don't think about language all that much, maybe, when we think about the areas of STEM study versus something like studying literature. But you talk about how the language of science has evolved into a lexically dense, impersonal, fact-driven type of discourse. I think you're actually quoting a professor by the name of Byron A. Brown in characterizing sometimes the way math and science is talked about in this way, and that this can be a particularly difficult point for certain students. Can you just talk about that and to what extent this particular issue can be addressed in a meaningful way?
Oh, it absolutely can be addressed. And I want to express my appreciation. It's a pleasure to be interviewed by somebody who actually has read the book carefully, and I appreciate that. Let me tell you that when I was a student in high school, college, graduate school, the single author whose work influenced me the most, when I first read what he had to say, it just blew me away, was an anthropologist named Benjamin Whorf. And he wrote about how the language you learn very much shapes the reality you can perceive. And that's why in writing the section that you're quoting from, I I was very sensitive to how this issue of how the language of math and science can drive students away. These are unfamiliar concepts. They need to be explained carefully. In much of the thinking and writing and teaching I've done, when I've reflected about the teaching process, what's most important is to connect to the frame of reference the students brings to the classroom. And this means that if their frame of reference doesn't include these terms, they're going to get lost. And so step one is careful definition, presenting the concepts in a way that students can incorporate them into what they already know and can own them. And, you know, there are language issues that contribute to the achievement gap that we were discussing. I described some research that was done about the SATs. There is an achievement gap in the SATs between majority and minority students. And this means that minority students don't have the same access to the same colleges because of lower SAT scores. But that gap can easily be erased. And there are two main factors that contribute to that. There are three factors that contribute to that. And I could describe the others, but one of them has to do with language. One researcher from the Educational Testing Service, working with voluminous data about the SAT, found that when African-American students do more poorly than white students on the SAT, it's because they trip up on the easy items. On the difficult items, they do just as well as the white students. And you might say, well, why would that be? Why would there be an achievement gap such that African-American students score lower? And it's because they're missing the easy items. And the reason is that the so-called easy items use words that are considered or assumed to have the same meaning to everybody. But in different subcultures, even common words have slightly different meaning. The difficult items use words nobody ever heard of. They're defined in a sentence or used in a sentence, and then a question will be asked about that word. And in that situation, everybody's on a level playing field. So I think that you really hit upon a key issue, that language shapes what we can perceive, that learning math and science requires mastering the concepts, what they mean, incorporating them into your thinking, and that the unfamiliarity with those terms can drive a student away from science.
Absolutely. And, of course, it can drive them away from a lot of things. I mean, I remember just getting frustrated reading Shakespeare because I couldn't read Shakespeare the same way I could read Tennessee Williams. I mean, that at the very outset, in terms of taking in the language and on the most basic level trying to understand, what did that character just say? What did that character just mean? What's happening here? That was so much more difficult at that point. And unless you're afraid of flunking, or unless you know that this is valuable to know on some level, it's very easy to become so frustrated that you just discard that experience altogether. And but I really appreciated how your book points out that the STEM areas pose, in some respects, a very similar sort of potential difficulty for a lot of students.
And that's a terrific analogy. I had the same reaction to Shakespeare as compared with Tennessee Williams and other modern writers. It's the same issue.
Later in your book, actually, when you are really, I think, focusing more on the collegiate level versus the middle school, high school level, and again, talking about why this achievement gap tends to persist, one distinction that was discovered in a study done, I believe, at Berkeley was a study of how various types of students would study and how, for instance, African-American students, it was found, almost invariably studied alone. And as I read that, I was reminded of a study that was done actually right here in southeastern Wisconsin by two university professors, both women, both in the sciences, studying this issue of why women tend to avoid this subject area, and then even for those relatively few who would enter the field, why so many of them don't stay in the field, that it often came down to this matter of solitude, either perceived solitude, that this is an area where you spend a lot of time sitting at a desk looking at test tubes all by yourself or poring over dense mathematical formulas by yourself, versus other kinds of academic pursuits where it feels like it's going to be more collegial. And your book points out that the areas of STEM can also be much more collaborative and collegial if they are taught in that way.
Oh, absolutely. The Berkeley program and research began with the observation that African-American students were flunking calculus at a much higher rate than other students. And the researchers noticed this problem of isolation, partly because these were African-American students in a predominantly white institution. But after all, these were African-American students who had excelled enough in high school to be admitted to Berkeley. The researchers thought, maybe this isn't about all the usual reasons that are given. Maybe it's about how they're studying. And the Chinese students were excelling. The researchers got permission to observe them. They were studying in groups. There was another dimension also. They were studying to excel. They were doing extra problems. They didn't want just to pass. They wanted to excel. So the researchers then created a workshop for the African-American students with those characteristics, that they would study in groups, that there'd be dialogue, and yes, there'd be faculty members or teaching assistants leading the groups. But they'd also, the purpose of those workshops for the African-American students was for them to excel. Very high expectations. And those workshops were enormously successful. The African-American students in the workshops, A, outperformed the African-American students who weren't in the workshops, and B, outperformed all the other students. And it is a dramatic example of why I'm optimistic, how the achievement gap can be erased. And yes, similar problems exist for young women in science that as you described from the research by the two women professors in southeastern Wisconsin. And there's an additional reason for optimism in looking at the male-female achievement gap, and that is it's been changing in recent years more than the other achievement gaps, but it shows that indeed any of these achievement gaps can be erased. There still are many challenges facing women who want to go into STEM fields in higher education, barriers that should be removed, but many barriers have been removed so that, you know, women in high school, it's no longer the case that, well, boys study science and women don't. It's no longer the case that young men are going to college in greater numbers than young women. It is still the case that, unfortunately, that there's a glass ceiling in academia where women don't progress through the faculty ranks as rapidly as men. But that situation is changing also. And it's very good to see those constructive changes happening.
Hmm. We're speaking with Professor David E. Drew about his book, STEM the Tide, Reforming Science, Technology, Engineering, and Math Education in America. My eyes lit up when I came across the name Parker Palmer in your book, because I've had the pleasure of interviewing this fine author on this program. You quote him in a book called The Courage to Teach, saying this: "I am a teacher at heart, and there are moments in the classroom when I can hardly contain my joy, when my students and I discover uncharted territory to explore, when the pathway out of a thicket opens up before us, when our experience is illumined by the lightning life of the mind. Then teaching is the finest work I know." You spend a great deal of time in your book talking about the significance of quality teaching, and that there is probably nothing more important in all of this, in terms of addressing this concern, than increasing the quality of teaching in our country. What would you say would be one of two of the most important things for us to consider about this?
Just to repeat and underscore what you just said, that out of all the strategies, I consider that the most important strategy or set of strategies in increasing the quality of teaching. For example, there's been much more federal money spent, and money at all levels spent, ever since Sputnik, ever since the 1950s, on curriculum reform. And curriculum reform is valuable, but it's not as valuable, in my opinion, as increasing the quality of teaching. Second, you often hear people say, okay, I get it. We've got to increase the quality of teaching. Now, how can we recruit the best college graduates into teaching? And that, too, is important, but it's not the key. The key is not recruiting excellent teachers. The key is retaining excellent teachers. Roughly half of all new teachers, 50%, leave the profession in the first 5 years. And that's because this is an extremely challenging job. It's a rewarding job, but it's hard work under stressful conditions, and because teachers do not get the respect in this country that they get in the countries that outperform us on the international scene, in international assessments. And so I think, so if that many teachers, new teachers are leaving, trying to increase the quality of teaching is a little bit like pouring water into a sieve. Again, the problem isn't finding new teachers, the problem is keeping them. And I discussed several programs that are effective, but really what it boils down to is support, continuous learning by teachers, which translates into what we call professional development, opportunities for them to reflect about their teaching, to learn the latest techniques, to be intentional about it, and really opportunities, the need to show to support them and to respect them. I've been hesitating to get into the very politically controversial area of how much teachers are paid, which I know has been a flashpoint in Wisconsin, but I basically believe that we should be paying our excellent teachers more than we do, that they are so valuable to our society. And going back to the points you made in the introduction to this discussion, this issue of education, of STEM education, is so vital to our nation's economic productivity over the coming years.
One of the points you make in talking about the stresses that teachers face, and also in addressing the important issue of us doing a good job of evaluating what we do, first of all, you point out the importance of evaluation being done very, very carefully and in sophisticated fashion, with not just simple numbers. I mean, a simplistic approach to evaluation and assessment is a very, very poor way of doing something which you believe to be very important. And You talk about No Child Left Behind in such interesting fashion. I wonder if you would share with our listeners this amazing metaphor of the metaphor between assessing children in the classroom and their progress, and what we would do if we did such a thing in hospitals. I've never seen the argument put quite this way, and it really makes one think.
I would be happy to. And, you know, in addition to being a researcher and writer, as I've mentioned, I'm a teacher. And for me, often, teaching is about metaphors, finding a way to connect with the student's frame of reference. And I got to thinking about the problems with No Child Left Behind as I observed them. And I thought assessing hospitals instead of schools provides a useful metaphor. What if we were to decide that we had to assess hospitals, again, parallel to schools, to see whether they're doing a good job? And that, we ought to be measuring things. And we all know that there are a number of quantitative indicators of health status. Any of us who have had a physical have seen all kinds of numbers. And what if the people doing the evaluation decided, you know, really the two key numbers are blood pressure and cholesterol. And so we are going to track how hospitals are doing by measuring the blood pressure and cholesterol levels of the patients. But, you know, we're going to do that frequently. We're going to do it every hour. And while this is an exaggerated metaphor, you would find that patients wouldn't be getting well as rapidly as they did in the past because they're not getting any rest. They're constantly being having their blood pressure checked or having blood drawn for cholesterol reading. You can picture the evaluator coming around. There's a patient who's been recovering, who's swimming in the pool, getting some exercise, and the evaluator says, well, wait, no, yank him out of the pool because now we have to take some of his blood to do a cholesterol measure. And eventually, really skilled physicians and nurses would say, well, this is crazy. I'm going to find another way to practice my profession because I don't want to have my work interrupted all the time by these measurements, which are nice, but they're only a tiny part of the picture, but it's disrupting everything else. And, of course, the metaphor, I think, in a nutshell, we're doing too much testing, that it's, while I believe in rigorous evaluation, as you noted in the book, that we're focusing on just a few indicators, and also I believe we are confusing the issue of how you evaluate an institution, a school, with how you fully evaluate an individual.
Mm. And of course, one of the last points on this list, as you take us through this metaphor, you say, suppose the hospitals that performed poorly on the blood pressure tests were told they had to improve or risk heavy federal sanctions, but were given no resources, such as blood pressure medication or educational materials, to change the situation.
Yes.
It's a very, very interesting way to look at a highly charged issue. We should say that your book goes on to outline in very specific, thorough fashion a number of encouraging success stories about ways and places in which the achievement gap has been closed. You address the very important issue of teaching versus research, about the funding of scientific research, and ultimately all kinds of encouraging, exciting possibilities for us to do a whole lot better with the area of STEM in the future. The book, again, is called STEM the Tide, Reforming Science, Technology, Engineering, and Math Education in America. The book is published by Johns Hopkins University Press. The author, Professor David E. Drew. Professor Drew, I'm so glad we had this chance to talk about your book. And for as thoroughly as we talked about it, there's all kinds of things we did not get to address We'll leave it to our listeners to seek out your book and see all that it has to offer. But I thank you for being so generous with your time and for writing this very intriguing book.
And thank you for this very thoughtful interview. I enjoyed it.
Support for the WGTD Morning Show comes from Carthage College.